My name is Don Rudrud. I'm a parish pastor at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Minneapolis in the inner city. I'm here on a sabbatical after 21 years of inner city ministry work. I'm ready for a little bit of refreshment. I'm really finding it here. I'm loving my work as a carpenter, and I've enjoyed teaching these days too with you, and thank you for all of your encouragement. As people come in, I'd like to review something that we did actually almost a week ago now, but it's sort of a basic design. Take these chairs, sit wherever you want. I'll mostly be sitting down. This is a design that I sort of came up with that helps me understand what's going on in the city parish. And I'll just go over it with highlighting a couple of words that will be very important to what we say tonight. Many of our city parishes have a rich tradition of theology and worship and the life of the faith, especially in the Lutheran tradition, and I'm thankful to say that many of those churches have not left the city or the inner city. They've stayed there with their rich tradition and history and understanding of word and sacraments, but they've experienced tremendous loss, especially in the 1950s and the 1960s. We know that hundreds of people in my city, among the ALC alone, within the city limits, 16,000 people left our city churches in the 10-year period from 1970 to 1980. Tremendous loss of membership. And because of that tremendous loss of membership in our city churches, there's been grief, tensions, denial, fighting within the congregation, sometimes splitting of the congregations. There's been change, obviously. Some congregations have died. I happen to have been familiar with churches that have committed themselves to stay in the city and to try to come to terms with the change and the new mission that is theirs in the community. That mission has a lot to do with taking seriously the parish. When I use the word parish, I define parish not as the members of a congregation, but as the neighborhood around the church. If we see that God has put us there to love those people, then it helps us to get by all kinds of barriers. For example, the question of racial inclusiveness. If we know that God has put us in that neighborhood, then whatever race of people that are living there are the people that we must relate to, and we must knock on their doors. A little story from my own congregation. When the first black member showed some interest in joining, he was married to a white woman. Some members of the church council thought in the 1950s that that was not appropriate. They told the pastor, "We're not ready for that yet." And so the pastor very wisely said, "Well, would you go with me as I tell these people why they cannot join our church?" That solved it for our church, and we broke the integration barrier. The church in the city has to be inclusive. In every way, it has to take seriously that people are not all the same. It has to include other races. It has to include new lifestyles of people. It certainly has to include women and the understanding of feminism in the leadership of the church. For my neighborhood is filled with young adults. Inner city areas are filled with young adults, and many of them are very sensitive to the issue of whether the church is really inclusive. I'm especially talking today about the issue of pluralism. I do not believe in a melting pot concept of America nor of a church. I don't think we can all melt into one. I think we have to affirm the fact that people are unique. They have their own culture and tradition. I happen to be proud of some of my Scandinavian tradition, and I want to maintain that. I don't want to lose it in my church. But I also want to be in a church that has next to me a black person that is proud to be black and can talk about black history and share with me all the rich culture of blackness. I'd like to be in a church where there are Southeast Asian refugees who can teach me something about the Asian mindset and about their own religious traditions of Southeast Asia. So pluralism allows the possibility of different ways of understanding life to exist side by side and not try to wipe each other out. Finally, a concept that I hope to get to if we don't get bogged down is the concept of indigenous. Indigenous leadership, a church that is really rooted in a neighborhood, that's leadership begins to be the people who live there. And if my neighborhood becomes all black, then I suppose I should have black leadership in my neighborhood, and certainly black leadership in the church of that neighborhood. If I'm in a situation where my neighborhood is partly American Indian, partly Southeast Asian, partly young adult white, and partly elderly Scandinavian, as I am, then I must concern myself with indigenous leadership from all of those groups. But the church cannot be vital and living in the city if its leadership lives in the suburbs and has to drive a half hour to come in and keep that church going. It has to keep finding a way to give over the leadership to the indigenous people who live there. It's the same concept we're working in foreign missions all over the world. The white missionary coming out of Minnesota cannot most effectively lead the church in Madagascar or in New Guinea or wherever it is. In fact, now in China, praise God, we've seen the mission of the Christian church opening up again in China. The Chinese government has very wisely said they don't want any missionaries to come there. If the church in China is going to thrive, it will be led by Chinese people, and it will be. So that's sort of my background, and now I'm going to let you talk a little bit because I'm going to ask a couple questions. How many of you have ever in your life been a refugee? Now, by a refugee, I mean someone that had to move away from your home and had to move because of some political events or some tremendous catastrophe, and you really didn't want to move, but you had to. And you were homeless, you had to travel. How many of you have ever been a refugee? Now, I'm surprised, because in most groups of this size, there would be somebody. If I asked that question, for example, in my congregation a few years ago, I would see some people there that are Latvians. They came during the Second World War time when the communist or the Russian government moved into their land and they had to flee. And they have been in this country now some 40 years, sponsored originally by my home congregation there, and still relating to the Lutheran Church after 40 years. They somewhat still think of themselves as refugees, although they have settled very much in Minneapolis. If you have not been a refugee, let's see a show of hands of how many of you are part of churches that have sponsored refugees. Many of you. Okay, that's very good. How many of you have personal experience of working with these refugees in their homes, helping them get jobs? Okay, several of you have done that. I won't ask the question how many of you are burned out from working with refugees, because that could happen too. Well, obviously, the work with refugees has become more and more a part of all of our work in the Christian church. We can't avoid it. I was trying to find the latest statistic, and some of you know it, so tell it if I'm all wrong, but the best I could find is that there are some 15 million refugees in the world right today. 15 million people that are on the move, not where they want to be, not really settled where they want to be. My heart is especially concerned about those 200,000 Cambodians who sit right now in refugee camps in Thailand, who are really caught between a rock and a hard place. They can't go back into Cambodia because the government is now communist and has taken over. If you saw the movie The Killing Field, you know the tremendous terror that they've gone through. But these people also now have been denied any more processing to come out of Thailand. And the Thai government soon may push them back into Cambodia, and there could be a terrible bloodbath. But we've heard of refugees more recently from Ethiopia. We know refugees from certainly Romania, Hungary. We know of refugees, whether they be called legal or illegal, that are coming from Central America, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and even the so-called migrant stream might be called refugees, although there we begin to get into kind of a confused definition, because when you have people coming because of tremendous economic pressure, it isn't the same as those who are forced because of violence or political pressure out of their country. But we know that thousands, even millions, are coming from Mexico, and more will be coming. I'm not an authority on that. I'm really not an authority on refugees, but I don't want to talk about all of that. I'd like to focus our attention specifically today on the question of Southeast Asian refugees as kind of a case study, and hope that you can apply it, whatever group that you might be especially working with or concerned about. The Lutheran Church has certainly been involved in settling Southeast Asian refugees. Right now, in the particular city I live in, and St. Paul connected, there are some 25 or 30,000 Southeast Asian refugees who have come in really within the last 8-10 years. 25,000 people that have added to our population. And if you looked at the sponsorship of those who sponsored them, many of them were sponsored by our Lutheran churches. We want to ask the question, why would Lutheran churches want to sponsor these people anyway? And I'd like to get some of your reasons. And this, you maybe have never asked this question. I think a lot of times we just jump into it and start doing it, and we don't even think why we're doing it. Why would you want to sponsor a refugee family? Anybody?
The need was presented.
The need was presented. It's a real need. And who usually presents it to you?
People came from Minneapolis. From the Synod.
From the Synod, okay. You hear it from the Synod, or you hear it from the president of the church, or you may hear it from a representative of the Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, who are really in the business of promoting it, to tell us there's a need. They're telling us that these folks are living in refugee camps and just barely surviving. And so many of them have swum rivers and gone out in little boats, and they're starving. I mean, they're desperate. They're ill. They need help. Okay, the need is presented, and that's a good way to respond as Christians. But why else are we doing it?
Bury you one of those burdens.
Yeah.
Oh. Christian duty.
Christian duty, a sense of Christian duty. You've heard those sermons, huh? They've really gotten through.
They say it loud enough and often enough.
Yeah. We quoted that Matthew passage, which just, you know, I don't think some Lutherans like to preach on that, but I don't know how you can squirm out of it. You know, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. I was naked and you clothed me. I mean, and Jesus says, as you have done it to one of these, the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you've done it unto me. Man, I mean, this is Jesus coming to us in these people. But there's some other reasons. Yeah.
It's a good thing we have the pericope schedules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, some of that stuff wouldn't be talked about.
Yeah. Especially a lot of us Lutherans were trained so much to talk from Pauline writings that we didn't get into all of those teachings of Jesus. But let's talk about some more reasons. There's some not so noble reasons, too, and it's okay to say them out loud, right, in this friendly group.
Government pressure.
Government pressure. And especially the government pressure of this government is to sponsor those people fleeing from communist kind of troubles. It's very clear, if you look at where the refugees are coming from primarily right now, they're coming from places like the Southeast Asian area and Eastern Europe. To a certain extent, a little bit from Nicaragua, but really not many from Nicaragua. And then for a while, we were experiencing a lot of them coming in from Cuba. It's a political reality that our government likes to present the fact that people are trying to get away from communism and we're open to it, right? Okay, it's a government. It's been a policy of our government to accept so many of these refugees. It seems to be closing down more and more, but it is a government pressure. There was a while, by the way, that, as I understand it, the limit of who came from who, which part of the world, was very clearly defined. But in 1965, the door started to open, and it opened in a new kind of way, especially to people from Southeast Asia. One statistic that I have here would say that in 1970, we had 1.7 million Asian people living in America. That's a small group, because for a long time, the door was closed to Asia for immigration. It was very limited. There was just not a good opportunity. But especially after the Vietnam conflict, and in those years, the door opened wide, and by the end of 1980, we had over 4 million. And it's more than that now. Now, I don't know how many people live in the state of Washington. Not by hands, but in numbers.
About
4
million.
About 4 million. So virtually, the population of this state of Washington is of Southeast Asian people has come into this country largely in our recent history. It's a whole new thing for us to experience. I studied for a while in Berkeley, California, and I found that Asian people now have been so upward mobile that they have moved to the top of the educational level in the state of California and are becoming the leaders in the state. They're clearly the people at the University of California that are the brains, you know. It's not always true of all of the refugees who are coming, however. Some of them come with very limited education. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, we have 15,000 of people that are Hmong. The Hmong grouping of people lived in the mountains of northern Laos. They were picked by our civilian intelligence agency, the CIA, to work for them in especially working with bombing and with gunnery because they have very good eyesight. Very few of them have glasses. They're very, very gifted in their eyesight. And these simple farming people who basically raised pigs and chickens became soldiers and worked for us. But their country was taken over by the communists, and they were clearly identified as friends of the United States. They had to get out. They had no choice. They were being massacred. Most any of them will tell me about visibly with their eyes seeing members of their family being killed. They are really on the run. And these people have come to a city like mine. They've also come to Fresno, California. I understand that a group in Seattle or in the West Coast here too. Well, you've given me some real good reasons, but you still haven't got some of the reasons that I've become aware of why we have sponsored these refugees. Anybody got any other reasons?
I would think one would be because it's the bold thing to do.
Okay.
It's fashionable and everybody's doing it.
It's the thing.
Yeah.
That was especially true a few years ago. I don't know if it's still the thing to do in your community, but there was a time when if the neighboring church sponsored a refugee, you felt a little guilty if you didn't. Okay? Other reasons. Let me give some that are not so easy to look at. I think Emily White might call this the dark side. There are some things that are not so easy to look at, but I think we've got to face them. There are certain people that sponsor refugees or even bring foreign students into their home for only one main purpose, and that's to evangelize them. Their understanding is that we can somehow get somebody in our home or in our church and we can give them Jesus, and they're a captive audience. And I really have questions about that. Especially if a person comes out of a deep religious understanding of their own religious faith, and they come openly thinking they're coming for another reason, and then come into our home or into our church and they get this pressure. So I have some concerns about that business, about a religious reason for sponsoring. There's another one this is only my theory, I can't prove it. But I suspect that we've all heard the need for pluralism and inclusiveness, and we've all been challenged to be an integrated people. And many of us feel a little awkward about the fact about how white our churches are. We feel kind of uncomfortable hearing that preached at us over and over again, and we look out there and it's all white. And so this is a chance to get somebody of color in our congregation. We're integrating, and we think pretty good about it. Now, I'm not sure that we do that all by the best motivation. I've heard people, in effect, say to me, they'd rather do this than deal with blacks, or they'd rather do this than deal with the American Indians in their community. And so it becomes a kind of a subtle pressure. And I don't know how widespread this is, but it's something that I have to struggle with, because in my neighborhood, it wasn't long after we started sponsoring our first Vietnamese families that some of the Indian people came to me and said, why are you working for them to get jobs when you're not working for me to get a job? And that was a tough thing to face, because all around me there were unemployed people and poor people. Well, I don't know how to define this. I guess I'd have to say that there's a concern about integration. Can you think of any other reasons why we've done it? Or why we are doing it?
The boy at Derby had a
I'm sorry, yes?
I was going to mention, specifically in the case of Salvadorian refugees, is because it's kind of the opposite of government pressure. The government is sending a lot of them back, and churches are realizing that they're going back to a difficult situation. So it's
good
kind of opposition to the government.
Yeah, okay. It's almost a kind of protest. Okay, I agree. And it's a protest that is done with very good motivation. I think concern about what might happen to these people. They may well be killed. And there's questioning whether our government is really right, whether our government isn't violating many laws here. Now, I'm not here to talk just about the Salvadorian situation. It's a bit of a different thing. But I would agree that that's a reason. Well, I don't know. There's probably other reasons. Sometimes I wonder whether our social concerns committees in some congregations just need a project. You know, they haven't figured out what to do, and it's a pretty good project, you know, so they take it on. However, the motivation, I'm glad we're doing it. And I'm not here to try to convince you to do it or to tell more about how to do it. I'd like you to go to your own agencies in your community. You can go to Lutheran Immigration and Refugee, Lutheran Social Service. You can go to Church World Service. You can go to Catholic Charities. A lot of people will help you to know how to sponsor refugees if you haven't done it. I think it still needs to be done. There are people waiting in the refugee camps right now for your help. If you're going to do it, I would say this. Don't expect it's going to be easy. Don't expect it's going to kind of just be taken care of real simply. It's going to take a lot of your time. It's going to take dollars. It's going to take sticking with people. It's going to take some frustrating, difficult things. But I'm not here to talk about it. I do want to mention you two who met me from Salem, Oregon, are a part of a church that has done a lot of this. And maybe you could just say for a minute when you got started with it and how many people have you sponsored in your congregation?
Hi, I'm Nita Carter from Salem. Our church is a Missouri Synod Lutheran Church of a congregation, I think, of about 340 people. The church began, and I don't really know how it began. It may have began with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service in 1972 with the first family. And that family was brought over and totally sponsored by the church for a period of probably a year until they got on their feet. Our time period now is a little bit less because of more communities resources helping. We have sponsored 16 families. And all, you know, the church really acts as a shepherd to these people. We all have sort of our own jobs to do, and it is really time-consuming. We have a family now that came to us in June from Thailand, a Cambodian family. There's a mom and a dad, a 19-year-old who is a double amputee. He was away from his family, excuse me, he was away from his family for a while, was trying to find them, stepped on a landmine, and lost his legs. He has many special problems. He has some psychological problems because of a Vietnam-type syndrome, where he was in charge of many children and saw much killing and death, or killing and was responsible for some death. And there's a 14-year-old and a 4-year-old, and we've had a variety of experiences with him. The church as a whole just works together, and we've been pretty successful. And some of our some of our families have stayed within the congregation. Some of them haven't, and our goal is not to convert them, especially to our Lutheran church beliefs, but to give them a chance to be able to go on, you know, and make a new life for themselves. And it's been real rewarding.
Thank you. We'll let you get into it again, maybe a little bit. But my concern, as I said, is not to talk exactly about the mechanics of sponsorship. I want to now get to the heart of my topic, and that is I'm concerned about what happens with these folks 5 years after they're in the country, 10 years after they're in the country. Will we see some of these folks like the people from Latvia 40 years after they're in the country? And what needs to happen for these people to find the real kind of justice and home that they seek in this country? Many of them, if not most, wish they could go back to their own country, but it's impossible, at least as long as the political situation is as it is right now. I added an eighth one, and that is, I guess I'll admit this personally, I have guilt over what happened in Vietnam. You know, I am part of a country that has guilt over what went on in Vietnam. There's something really tragic and terrible about the tremendous death and uprooting of people that happened there, and I want to do something about that. Well, let's talk about the 5 years, the 10 years. In our parish, we had to start facing that question because we soon saw that our call was not just to sponsor more refugee families. Because we saw, in the early 1980s, we saw 20 families move in, 50 families move in. We finally saw that our neighborhood is becoming the place where most of them came because the housing was for the poor. They could get in four or five families sometimes in the same apartment and nobody would enforce the housing code in our neighborhood, but out in the suburbs they'd enforce it. They found that they wanted to live close together, and we had a ministry given to us by God by this definition of parish that we had to take seriously. We had hundreds of people all around us. I still remember in 1980 seeing a woman walk to our local laundromat with a basket that was twice as big as she was filled with laundry. It looked like she had just been on, you know, I thought I was in the refugee camp in Thailand. You know, she was looking exactly, she was dressed in the costume of her people, and she was carrying the, instead of to the Mekong River or something to wash her clothes, she was going to the local laundromat. I could not avoid dealing with refugees personally because of something that happened in Spokane, Washington. I want to tell you the story. I showed up in church at Our Savior's one Sunday morning, and there was a man who I found later was Hmong, sitting towards the back of the church, and he wanted to see the pastor. He couldn't speak English very well, but I got this much out of him. He had been sponsored by a Lutheran congregation in Spokane, and now he'd moved to Minneapolis, and he wanted to find the Lutheran church right away. He was a member of the church in Spokane. He had been baptized in the church in Spokane, and he wanted to connect with the church. And I wish more of our American Scandinavians and Germans would do that. You know, he really was seeking out the church the very first thing that he came to the community. And so we had a member who was Hmong. But we not only had a member, but he brought along his 8 kids. He brought along his wife, who didn't speak English at all. And we had to begin to relate to them. Well, what are we going to do? We didn't know what we were doing. You know, we hadn't sponsored Hmong. We had sponsored Vietnamese. Some of the Vietnamese that we had sponsored were now at the university doing quite well. But these people had very simple education. I soon learned that among the Hmong, 60% of the women had no education at all before they came to this country. 40% of the men, no education at all, and in the sense that they did not know how to read or write their own language.
There was no written non-language even at the time of the Vietnam crisis.
Well, about 30 years ago, the Missionary Alliance missionaries did do some help in writing down a language in order that they could get a Bible in their hands. But that's right, these people lived up high in the mountains, they were farm people, they really didn't need, you know, education as we understand it. But now they were coming to the city and they needed it. By the way, a little footnote of interest is that the Lutheran Church, to my knowledge, had absolutely no evangelical missionary work in all of Southeast Asia. Among all these people that we call Vietnamese, Cambodia, Hmong, we had no Lutheran missionaries sent out to work among them. The Catholics were working among them, the Missionary Alliance Church wasn't working among them, but we find that their religious tradition is not Lutheran. However, there is a somewhat troubling story to tell about when I met another Hmong man who came to my new member class, and through a translator now, I had to work with a translator, I asked the question whether he'd been baptized. He thought for a while and he said, "Oh yes, I've been baptized in the river back in my country." And then I said, "What church baptized you?" And he said, "It was the CIA Lutheran Church." I don't know who baptized him. I mean, it may have been a soldier that baptized him. I suspect it was the Missionary Alliance Church that baptized him, and he got that confused, but communication was troubling. What we did is we began to meet these people. It wasn't just a few weeks later, a man named Liam Mua contacted me. He had been given my name by Lutheran Social Service because he had contacted them. He said that he had been sponsored by a church out in Rhode Island and knew the pastor real well. In fact, he told me, and this man spoke English pretty well, he said, "The pastor took me fishing every week." And he said that he had taken instruction there, and now his wife had told him that they couldn't stay in Minneapolis if they didn't find their Lutheran church. We have what now is happening for us called secondary migration. People that are moving, on the move, coming to the city of Minneapolis because there are a lot of their own people there. Even back in Thailand at the camps, it becomes known as Hmongiapolis. Because there are so many people of their culture that are finding it as a place where they can find educational opportunity, where the welfare system is helpful, where there are good people. There are good Lutheran people that are welcoming them. So I had my second family that joined. And before I knew it, people were coming and I wasn't prepared for them. Some of them even wanting their children baptized. And then the question came of counseling with them. And boy, did they bring me some troubling questions. You know, I remember Liam Mua telling me, he said, "I'm on a grant here now of some help from the government, but that's going to run out and they're going to close that out and I'm going to be out on the street very soon. I have to have a job, quick. Can you get me a job?" And I remember another man who had a tremendous domestic quarrel with his wife. He didn't speak English very well, but the wife somehow learned that she could call the police in on the situation, and she called the police in on the situation, and they arrested this man, and he was in jail, and they didn't speak his language, and he was very unhappy in jail. And what made it even worse is once the wife realized that her husband was in jail, she thought that he was going to be persecuted and then to be killed. That was her understanding, and so she completely went out of her mind. I remember having to physically drag her away from the jail because she was acting in such a crazy way that I was afraid they would hospitalize. Try to counsel those people and to get them back together again. I was totally limited. I don't speak this language. I don't have the equipment to deal with the kind of questions that I was beginning to be presented. I remember another situation. A divorce was beginning to develop between two of these refugee people, and they wanted me to be the one to mediate it. In their culture, an elder or one of the people that is even connected with their religious life is the one that they take these problems to. And somehow they had thought that I should be that now in this culture. The woman was probably Buddhist, or her background was so different that she was and to go through her own religious ceremony right in our church. And I had to decide, do I allow that? The man wanted a lawyer. And do I get him a lawyer? And do we start introducing them to all of the legal system of America to go through divorce? troubling kind of things for me. And I finally realized that I needed help. So I did what I guess I recommend any of us do when we feel we're in over our head. I tried to bring in the kind of people that would know the best, and that is the leaders of the culture of the people, the indigenous leaders. I tried to meet some Hmong leaders that happened to be Christian or that happened to be respecting their community and that spoke English. And we developed a conference at Lutheran Social Service where we just spent several nights listening to these people talk about their culture. We learned about, for example, that the Hmong people are not primarily Buddhist. That might have been my assumption, but they are primarily animists. Their background, their religion is centered in the animal world. We had a little bit of that even last night here, but their use of animals is rather strange. They sacrifice animals, they pass their body between animals and their religious leader called a shaman, and saying certain prayers, they try to pray their dead through the spirit worlds way back to China, where the Hmong people see their original origin. There is a shaman, a religious leader of their people, this animistic religion, very much centered in nature. And I had to even eventually meet one of them to begin to understand what that's all about. But at this conference at Lutheran Social Service, we asked finally the question at the end of the meetings, what is the thing you as a people want most from us? How can we help as the Christian church? Can you guess what they said? They did not say, bring us Jesus. What did they say? Jobs was one thing. And what was the other?
Housing.
Many of them had some kind of housing, although, and in our city we have public housing too, so it wasn't the biggest issue, although some I think wanted to get into cheaper housing.
Education.
But they wanted education, and they especially asked something that I hadn't expected at first, but it makes all the sense in the world. They wanted English. They wanted to know how to speak English. Now I began to click in my mind some thoughts. That's something we can do. We may not be able to get jobs for all these folks, although our churches are filled with people who are employers and have an opportunity to know when jobs become available, but we can teach English, even if we're not trained teachers. And we began to look at the Lavak system, we began to look at other systems in other cities, and we devised a very simple system of tutoring refugees with a volunteer tutor tutoring five people three nights a week in the basic stuff, reading street signs, knowing how to figure out some of the simplest information about getting health care. And our volunteers were trained at a program that's in most of your cities through something called a Literary Institute or the Lavak program. Ours was the Minnesota Literacy Institute, and we worked with the International Institute. They provided virtually free 15 hours of training for anybody who's willing to volunteer. Church members could do that. We had young adults do that. We had senior citizens do that. They went through the training, and these people began to meet their little group of five students. And they would come faithfully and want to immediately be able to write, want to immediately be able to do a lot of things. We set certain goals. Our goal was to teach English, but also to teach survival skills in the city, how to survive in the city. What do you do, you know, when you're having trouble with the American Indian family that lives down the street because they're very jealous of you being in the neighborhood and there's turf questions? What do you do when you got rodents and cockroaches? We had somebody come in and talk to them about cockroaches. We had to hire a bilingual translator because many of the folks we were starting with ground zero. They didn't know English at all. So we had a translator that helped us. We had volunteers who used the simplest methods. We made a few mistakes, but the program has been going now for 6 years. And we still have about 50 or 60 students that come every night because we offer a free school in the church using the Sunday school rooms where people can come and find somebody that cares about them and is willing to help teach them. Yeah.
In my area, there's an instance where this woman, she lives alone, and I think she came through the church with the Laotian people.
Mm-hmm.
She would then take a couple of children, and you know, she would have signs on all her different articles in the house.
In the house, yeah.
And in that way, she teaches them.
It's a great
way. Children year after year.
Yep.
And it's worked out quite well. And she's an older woman.
Yep.
But he gives her something to do and also.
We found that in our city there was an English as a Second Language program, especially developed with public funding for the children. They were pretty well taken care of. And often for the men. in order that they could get ready to get a job. Our general philosophy in America is get people to work and give them. So the men often had a chance to go to school during the day, but the women were limited because they had 5-6 kids. They had to watch the kids at home. So we developed our school in the evening so that the women especially and some of the elderly could come that didn't qualify for the other programs. We also found that some of these programs that are publicly supported only go for so many months, and then they're off on their own. And what made it even worse in the city of Minneapolis, they started to close some of these programs because of budget problems. They had been hiring ESL teachers on an hourly basis instead of contract, and the question became, should they have contracts? And once they got contracts, we couldn't afford it anymore as taxpayers, so we started to close the schools down. But our church program kept going. We have, to this day, not put a single federal dollar into the program. It's all church monies that help pay our coordinator and our Hmong bilingual translator. But some other things became clear. If you're going to have the women coming in the evening, it isn't always going to happen that the father is going to be there in the home, or there's going to be a father that's going to watch all those kids at home. So we began to have to offer childcare. So we said, instead of just offering babysitting, let's develop a school for the little children, too, and teach them English. And that became exciting. It's that old Head Start idea, you know? And with volunteer members of the church, and I have to admit to you, during the same time our Sunday school enrollment was going down, 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 but our evening enrollment was going up, up, up. We were using the church to help these Southeast Asian children learn English. And we weren't afraid to do it at times in the name of our Christian faith and to make it a little bit of a Christian school, but we always were real careful about pushing the religious thing on anybody. We did it primarily motivated by the love of Christ, but not teaching Bible. Now, I did offer a class on Sunday morning for these people that wanted to study about the Christian faith, and we used material that Bonnie Zeller helped to develop in your congregation and Missouri Synod background, and that is some of the good early material that's available. Now the National Lutheran Council has produced some other material. Christ Lutheran Church, the Southeast Asian Ministry Program in St. Paul, has published the Catechism, the Lord's Prayer. A lot of these things now are available in languages if you need printed material. But I found it frustrating to try to teach these folks through a translator to know how to best approach their culture. I knew so little about their culture. I went to a fine college of the Lutheran Church and a theological seminary, and I never had a course in comparative religion. There's something wrong about that. We need to learn about the religions of the world. We need to understand, you know, about what Buddhism is. We need to understand the animistic religion. And I felt unprepared. And so more and more, I have moved in my own thinking towards what this word really is all about, indigenous. I've tried to form friendships with people of the cultures that know best these people. I'd like to read you a quote that comes from no less a source than the Vatican in Rome, the head of worship for the whole Roman Catholic Church. It happens to be an interesting quote to me. Two quotes. First of all, he says, where the church has become indigenous, where the hierarchy and laity come from the ranks of the people, there her liturgy will have to be native. A borrowed rite is an alien rite. And then later he says, as long as the church prays and speaks in the foreign language, whose pattern of thought and mode of expression is alien to the people, all efforts at adaptations of liturgy or whatever you do remain superficial. This means that the church has not penetrated the realm of the spirit nor fully appreciated the native genius of the people. Language is an authentic manifestation of the way people form ideas and inner and interiorly react to objective reality. Language communicates the soul and spirit of the people. About this time, maybe 1983 or 4, I was feeling a call, like many missionaries do, I better learn the language of these people. I'm going to communicate in their language. And one or two members of our church actually went to work and started studying it. And we started to teach their language in our church. Now, we had the advantage that many churches don't, and maybe yours didn't, is that we found more and more we were working just with the Hmong. Although we had had Laotian and Cambodian and Vietnamese come to our church, they sort of self-selected themselves out and began to find their own places, and the Hmong kept coming. So now I had the question, do I learn Hmong? I've always been a lousy student of language. I didn't do well in college in that. And what made it even more confusing for me is at the same time I was feeling the call to the American Indian ministry in my neighborhood, because we have 15,000 American Indians living all around our church too. and I should learn the Ojibwe language, and I should go to Sweat Lodge, and I should become involved in the rights of the Indian people, too, if I want to communicate to them. So I came to a conclusion that I may not be able to learn the Hmong language personally, but I could seek out a spiritual leader that would work side by side with me on my staff that would know how to relate to them. And we found two such people. First, I baptized myself. His name is Singh. He's an orphan. Both of his parents killed in the war. He wants to be an elementary school teacher. I got him enrolled at the old Golden Valley Lutheran College. And although that college doesn't exist anymore, they were very good to help welcome him and get him started in his college career. Now he's transferred to Augsburg, and he still works at our church. And he is preparing to be a leader, maybe in the church, at least in education. It's a delight to see someone kind of grow up through the congregation into some leadership in the community. Another leader we found was working at Lutheran Social Service. He happens to be Methodist in his Christian commitment, but very articulate in the English and Hmong language, and we hired him as a translator, then as our co-director, and now, this month of September, he has begun as the director of our language school. We have developed indigenous leaders among the people. He runs the show, and we as the Americans kind of take our clue from him. Now that was not easy to do. There were people in our church that says, we're not ready for that. There are people saying, we're just setting him up to fail. But we are convinced that that is absolutely the way the ministry has to move. And now my latest project, and I'd like to get some of you to help me with this. I'd like to see us support the creation of scholarship funds that will pay part of the education of some of these good people, of the Vietnamese, Cambodian, all of these cultures of people, so that they might go to college and possibly theological seminary, or at least to a school to become lay catechists, lay worship leaders, to work in our churches. I think we need them desperately. The LCA has 31 people now in their ministry, either lay professional or pastoral ministry, that are Asian, and that's great. Our American Lutheran Church is far behind that. We need these people desperately. Indigenous leaders raised up from the communities, best able to communicate to their own people, not only the gospel of the words of Jesus, but also the gospel of English and where to find a job and how to deal with the welfare system and all of these things. Now, I've talked quite a bit, and time is going, so I'm going to pause a while and let you say something back to me. And you can disagree. That's fine.
We found that just putting the kids right in the public school, I think it's really nice when...
Yes. Kids are going to make it okay.
At their age level, and boy, they
yep.
took right off and went.
I tell you a story. One of these young Cambodian boys came, and within the first 2 weeks he was here, I invited him to go up to Wilderness Canoe Base on the Canadian border with our church kids, and he came along. And after that, he came back and asked for my help and a few other things. And before long, he asked if he could come and live with me. And we did it. We let him come and live with me because it was obvious he was in a wretched situation. And this young man has now not only left our home, but he is now down in Georgia attending the University of Georgia and is headed for a PhD in physics. And I think we'll do fine. I mean, he's very upward mobile. This guy is going to be making a lot more money than I could ever dream of. The kids are going to make it in many ways. There are some that are very damaged by the war. You mentioned the man with the amputees. You know others that have psychologically been missed. That's troubling. There are some of these folks we found that are so affected by that that they are subject to mysterious kind of illnesses and diseases. We've even had some mysteriously die in the middle of the night. No one can explain why. And there are things that make it tough. But I'm concerned about the older people, the elders that don't quite fit into these language programs, the people that need, I think, to hear the worship service in their own language. I tried inviting these people to church. We had times when we had 30 and 40 of them on Sunday morning occasionally visiting our church. They come in clans, at least the Hmong do. If the clan leader comes, he'll bring all the relatives. That's all great, but they would sit there a few Sundays and not understand what we were doing at all and look at that green book for a moment and then close it and just sit there, and we begin to lose them. And we've steadily lost them from worship. We considered doing like the United Nations and having a simultaneous translation with earphones, you know. We looked at that possibility. Currently, we're most excited about a model that's happening in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where they have a Hmong pastor who is really has limited training, but he's learning on the job. He leads the worshiping community of Hmong that gather every Sunday in their chapel at Ascension Lutheran Church. And then the Sunday school kids all mix with the American kids. And then certain seasons of the year, like at Christmas and Easter, they have a big service where they all gather together, all the races of the congregation. And then they have festival times where they share each other's food. Isn't that a great way to get to know another culture, to bring the egg rolls and set them next to the lutefisk? You know, to have a time where you really celebrate the culture. I mean, in some ways, our congregation is so excited about what's happened to us because the whole world has come to our doorstep. It's not just that the Southeast Asian people are there, but Ethiopian refugees has come into our neighborhood. We've had people from the Indian reservations. We have the whole world. You know, we don't have to go to be a missionary somewhere else.
There's getting to be real qualified help, too, for the Southeast Asian people who have problems. The young man that we had, you know, with the psychological problems because what he's been through, is currently at the University of Oregon in their Health Science Center. There is a psychiatrist there who is working with a Southeast Asian psychologist, and they have done lots of good things for these people who can't function in our society right now because of the things that they've been through in the past. And Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Society knows of these people, and that's how we tapped into getting help for this young man. And it will be, you know, many, many months or years even before he is able to function properly, you know, what we feel is properly.
Say one more thing about pluralism that I wanted to say, and I just noticed in my notes that I better do it because some of you won't be here next week. And next week I'm going to be talking a lot about this stuff as I'm concerned about theological education, training of leadership. But I'd like to share something that a pastor, Puig, P-U-I-G, has shared with me that I think is worth looking at. It's the question of pluralism or different cultures. You have a culture. Let's assume that it's the culture of Our Savior's Church, the one I come from, 117 years of Norwegian tradition. The second congregation of Norwegian immigrants to come to Minneapolis. You know, strong culture. I mean, those folks often break into Norwegian right in the church talking. I mean, these people know their culture. You got culture A here. Proud of their culture, know it. You see evidences of it around the church. But it's in the city, and this faces the possibility of culture B. What's going to happen when culture B and culture A come into interaction? There's going to be something that happens. Now, what can happen is that one option is that the congregation can basically affirm culture A so strongly that culture B just gets wiped out. If you're going to come and join us, folks, you're going to do the LBW just the way we do it. If you're going to come and join us, you're going to have to laugh at our Norwegian jokes because that's the way we are. You know, if you're going to come and be part of us, just kind of forget all that stuff about the shaman and about Hmong New Year, and forget all that stuff about the gong, the instrument that you play, because we play organ here. This is culture A. Okay, that's one option. I think it's a dismal option. It's the way we've usually gone, and I think it's going to doom us to mission failure. There's a second option. Here you have culture A, and you've got culture B, and you've got the congregations especially concerned about integration. Now, the word integration has been important to me. I came to the 60s in inner city ministry. I talked integration over and over again, but I now have more questions about integration because this model says that the congregation will be neither A nor B. It'll be some new kind of creation that's sort of like all melted into some kind of new dream. Now, it sounds kind of neat, but I think it's bad for these folks that have this rich culture and tradition, and it's bad for these folks that have this, and what you have often in the middle is unsatisfying for everybody. This is the kind of service, for example, that you go to, and it's a hodgepodge worship service. It's got some soul music in it. It's got an old Norwegian pious song. It's got an altar call as well as incense or something. I mean, it's just trying to mix it all in together, and it just doesn't seem to do it. Now, there's a third option, which is more and more at least what I'm trying to begin to look towards. And that is, here you have culture A still there, culture B, and more we're finding culture C and culture D. We're trying to deal with this too. and you create a congregation that affirms both A and B pluralistically and says they're both okay. Maybe they even worship separately in the building, but occasionally get together for big things like a meal or the annual meeting of the congregation. They may both have the same pastor, but the pastor has the sensitivity and ability to know how to relate to both. The pastor more and more needs to be bilingual. I confess to you, I've not learned the Hmong language, but that's a great weakness in my ministry. More and more in our theological seminaries, we're at least going to have to be requiring Spanish, for that's the largest alternate language in this country, and it will become more and more so in our lifetime. If you cannot have one pastor that can relate to both groups, then we will have two pastors side by side, one relating to one to the other, and those pastors will have to work in a kind of a way that affirms the body of Christ, the oneness of the church, but congregation still has pluralistically affirmed A and B, and they're both good and important.
Yeah. And they should be co-pastors.
All right.
Co-pastors rather than a senior and a junior.
I am with you, and I agree with you, and I've been fortunate to be part of it. I've been part of it's worked too. It's not worked in many other places.
Yeah.
Where it usually doesn't work is when they get so concerned about their jealousies and tensions between each other that they forget the mission of the church. If we can keep the focus on the mission of the church, then I think co-pastors can work. Well, this pluralism, bringing in the indigenous leadership is the dream that I have for where the church needs to move. It's a dream that not only I have, but it seems to be accepted generally by the American populace. We have come to the point where we are affirming the right of black people to be themselves and to be proud of themselves. We are affirming the fact that Indian people need to have their strong Indian traditions, and we dare not tell them to forget everything that they've ever learned for centuries about the care of the universe and about all their grandparents and about the land. But we must affirm that and value it and bring it within our life. And now we're going to have an inclusive church. And one of the things in the inclusive Lutheran church that you will see is not only quotas, and I want to talk about that next week too, not just quotas, but caucuses of Hispanic, caucuses of Asians, caucuses of black people that can get together and be strong together and affirm their history and give the gift to the whole church that they can give. And we will not be asking them to lose it all. And we will not be telling as many Scandinavian jokes anymore. We will become a church that is more and more pluralistic of the whole nation, of all the people. And I dream of that day. Now our time is almost up, but I'm going to give you the last chance to even disagree with what I've just said, or to share any other thought you have about how we might continue over the next 5, 10, 15 years to relate to these refugee people. And maybe 40 years from now, some of them will still be part of our congregation.
I think Evening Vespers at Holden is a very good example. Sometimes you go to Vespers, you might hear somebody speak of China. You might, yeah. I mean, there's just a variety of things that happen at Evening Vespers. Yeah.
For a while, we tried to integrate everybody into one worship service. Now we have two worship services. Next year, we hope to start a third one for Hmong people. The year after that, we hope to start another one out in the neighborhood, not meeting in our church, but meeting in an old school that is now not being used as a school anymore for people that don't even feel comfortable coming into church. And all four of those church services will be our church, but they will all be offering the way to worship God in a style that's pluralistic and affirming the differences within our community. Yeah.
I think in addition to trying to communicate in the language, that it's really important for anybody working with refugees, whatever their origin, to understand as much as possible about their culture. And my area has been providing health services. And I think of something as simple as how easy it is for us to pat a child on the head.
Yeah.
And how threatening that is to a Vietnamese child who has been taught that his head is sacred and only a parent will touch it.
Or just another item, like inviting the kids to go to camp. We say, come on, go to camp with us. You know what the camp means? even hold it. I suspect that there's a reason why a lot of those folks will not be comfortable coming this far away on a boat when they don't have communication and an easy way to get out of here. This is a threatening place to a lot of those people. So I agree. Yeah.
I want to point out again the opportunity that I have had to be with a congregation that is not as drastic as this,
yeah,
but one that combines 33 different denominations within our own American community, And we have an amazing pastor that can handle the whole group. And we're a very viable operation.
Good. That's great. Well, there's more to talk about. Let me just close with this one thing. Mount Olivet Lutheran Church, a big church in Minneapolis, has recently started a program which I'm very sold on. They do it along with us. It's called Friend to Friend. In that suburban church, they have matched up congregational members there with people in our language project to just get together once in a week like just friends, to eat food together, to go to a ball game together. And these aren't for recent refugees. These are for people that have been here 5, 6, 7 years. Some of them now have pretty good English skills. The Friend to Friend program. It's a good model for any place in the country to keep these friendships going and these relationships going. You'll be blessed by it. And I think your sense of mission will too. Well, thank you for all your contributions and enjoy the worship.